all about the other person.
Well, one question I've been asked is am I a am I a people pleaser? Mm. As though it's it's a thing, you know. Mm. It's
I'd say yes. Make me a fucking cake.
Make me a cake.
Yeah.
Okay. See the way I said okay then. I'm going to make you a cake now. You see.
How quickly can I get Richard a cake?
A lot of people pleaser. What would you like?
Now, again. Apparently, you know, the consensus of opinion, because we do what we do for a living, we're people pleasers. I think it's, it's another label. And people pleaser doesn't exist as a thing. It's a label we put on a set of behaviours, right? And if those set of behaviours are okay with you, then fine. But if there's a certain amount of resentment, and this is what I was talking about with a client, if you're doing something to someone, if you feel as though you're doing something, and there's a hint of a resentment there, then maybe that's you're looking at.
How do you know that? I'm with you, but how would you know then? How do you know to be resentful?
It's a feeling. Feeling they get.
I guess where I'm going with this is it because it's your values being offended? It's your boundaries, even though they might be weak. And how do we know this stuff? We know. You know, we've all worked with people, not just on this on like narcissistic and cluster B abuse type thing, but just in business and all the rest of it. And you say, how do you actually know that you feel that way? And I think at some level, it comes right back to that whole thing about values and boundaries, you know. I've known loads of people working in great jobs, great salary, great offices, cars, the whole lot. I just don't like working here. And when you go back, and the best case is actually me in some ways. Many years ago when I was in consulting, I was working for a company. It was the best account I'd ever been given, best in terms of fabulous people to work with, really creative organisation, great money, bonuses, because they had so much profit they could buy projects all the time. You know? It took me 8 months to become honest with myself. Mm. And I think I'm okay in saying out loud, the company was called British American Tobacco. Mm-hmm. And it took me 8 months to be totally honest, excuse me, I've got a bit of a sniffle, and I'd say, they kill people.
Right.
And actually, I know what it was. It was a sort of day when it happened. I thought, I started to see some of the marketing techniques they were using, which is all legal and above board, but I'm thinking, actually,
used to be
drug dealing.
Oh, yeah.
Let's show a sexy celebrity that everybody wants to be like, smoking.
Absolutely.
You know what that does to people's psychology. It's not it's not just like, oh, you think Clark Cable is cool and therefore you're going to think. It's more than that. It taps into deep unconscious drives, and it's done very, very deliberately.
But I hid that. Really. I mean, I know now, looking back, it was 20 years ago, looking back, from day one, I thought, oh, I don't really fancy working for, bloody hell, I can make that much bonus. And then I went in, felt uncomfortable, and then said, you know what, this is really offensive to my values.
Yeah,
I'd had to get out. And getting out was at some personal cost because I'd built up a good relationship with the clients, and my boss, the partner of the consulting company, didn't want me to dump him, you know, but had to be done.
Yeah.
Had to be done.
I had a very similar experience myself. I think I might have mentioned this. I was in a publishing company that were publishing diaries, right? And the way they were working, justified it. Oh, yeah, I justified it to myself because we gained great money.
Yeah, you do.
Nice big office.
Yeah.
Big team, 80 odd people, you know. I was a cheese. Mm-hmm. You know?
I
remember sitting in my big office thinking,
Cheddar.
I remember sitting in my big office thinking, okay,
smells
something. Cheese. Something. Yeah, stinks of cheese, yeah. Who moved my cheese? Who moved my cheese? Oh. So, and I think, this isn't right.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, because I'm going back, 30 years here now, something like that, I didn't have the, whatever you want to call it, experience or nous or whatever it might be, to just move. But what I found myself doing, I found myself sabotaging myself.
Yeah, right.
You know, I would deliberately, I'm not doing that. Mm. I don't like that.
Yeah.
And I found myself getting eased out. Do you know what I mean? Because I wouldn't do what they wanted me. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is a classic way of finding out whether you're in a narcissistically abusive relationship or not. Just start politely saying no.
Yeah.
And you'll find
absolutely
out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can find out soon enough whether you're in an abusive relationship.
That brings two stories together, doesn't it? What we're talking about is you know, if you're in a relationship to some degree. I mean, let's face it, we've got a self-selected group of people we deal with. We only get to see the people who woke up one morning and said no.
Yeah.
Sorts up to some degree, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a hard journey for some of them to go from no to I need help or I need to find somebody. It could be a hard journey. But, you know, there's a lot of people who either haven't woken up, think this is just life, you know, or don't have that bit of courage. So we've got a very good self-selected... Most of the people who sort of are watching your YouTube things online... I've got a lot of respect for them because they're starting to take courageous steps and break out, and it ain't easy.
It's not easy.
No.
It's very, very hard.
But I think to double back onto the point about, you know, it's their values, it's their boundaries, it's something not feeling quite right that triggers them to start looking.
Going back to that people-pleasing comment you made, how do you know you feel resentful? It's something's not quite right.
Yeah.
Something's not quite right.
So the resentment,
and you can't put your finger on it, but you know it's that kinesthetic. And that's what I work with all the time, actually.
So I think you're just banging the microphone there, mate.
Give the microphone a few digs there. Can you stop it? People who listen to this can fucking say,
you know what?
I work with this all the time.
You just stole my power.
yeah, it's beautiful. I loved it. Do it more. Richard Grannan is a psychopath and a sadist. Seen the interview. So you would say that resentment could be a classic symptom of a narcissistically abusive relationship?
No, in the context of pleasing people.
People pleasing.
People pleasing, yeah.
There are people out there who like talk about that more, being a people pleaser, being a nice guy, being a nice girl, and then just walking around feeling pissed off and resentful all the time. How nice are
you? Is it at the expense of yourself?
Yeah.
You know,
and does that aggression then start bleeding out onto the self, onto others?
Yeah,
against because you're not happy. Yeah. You haven't asked for what you wanted. You've not stood up for what you stand for, what you really stand for.
Yeah,
you've not stood up for what you stand for. We'll leave that.
You're not
asserting yourself and going, well, you know, I also have preferences here.
Yeah.
You think you're being. People have different narratives. It's a spiritual narrative. I'm a Buddhist. I'm a Christian. I'm self-sacrificing, or I do it for my kids. You can't. You're still a human being, aren't you? You're a mammal. You can't just give and give and give without there being a hostile response to the abuse. It's abuse. It's abuse. Whether you're choosing, or you think you're choosing, or you're having it taken from you, it's still an unbalanced relationship.
It's similar. It's like the old story, cutting off the goose's head that lays the golden eggs.
I really thought he was going to say cutting off the ghoulies.
I think he wasn't.
This is a PG.
Do you remember the old story about cutting off?
That's session seven.
Cutting off the narcissist ghoulies.
Maybe we should make it session one.
Yeah, we'll start there. Yeah. You'll feel a lot better when they're in your hand.
His emotional ghoulies.
Yeah, his emotional ghoulies. Yeah, we should be real clear on that.
Oh, well, we're talking metaphorically.
Do not advocate violence. Yes. So, cutting off the goose's head. Terry's got a story for us.
No, you've hit the stuck.
That's it. That's it.
Oh, you're putting your glasses
I'm
on.
I'm steepling my fingers.
I'm putting my glasses on. Okay.
We're just... Intellectual mode.
We're in intellectual mode. We're listening to you. God, you look so much clearer now. Fucking hell.
I can see every pore.
HD.
You're in HD now.
I am, yeah.
Go on, sorry.
Where was I? Oh, yeah.
Ghoulies and gooses.
The farmer goes. He goes into his barn one morning. There's a goose there. And she's laid a golden egg. Mm. And he goes, wow. And saw a golden egg. as you would.
That's what you'd say.
As you do, you know. So he puts it aside, you know, he goes next morning.
He puts it aside?
Yeah.
Sloppy.
In a safe.
He leaves it in the barn. He leaves it in a barn with geese in it. An egg made of
I don't believe this. Story,
this is...
No, I'm sorry.
He's making it up as he goes along. He's not a prophet.
Is this a narcissistic farmer, though? Because... is it? No, I mean, I'm just, you know...
All he does is take. He doesn't give anything to them geese.
And there's a sense of entitlement.
No, he feeds them. You know, he feeds them.
It's his.
Yeah.
Because you're mine. That's mine.
Because
he feeds them well.
He feeds them well. Fair enough.
He feeds them well, yeah.
But that egg belongs to the goose. He has no right to take it.
All property theft.
Well, yeah, you got me there.
And so begins the Marxist meeting. All property is theft, comrades.
Brother.
Brother, bring down the establishment.
Oh, God. Day five, there's five golden eggs there.
Right.
You know, and he goes, oh, crazy. What I'll do, I'll cut an egg off and get them all out. Right?
Oh, he was mad.
He was crazy, right? But yeah. The point of making this, right, the point of making this, if you're giving to your children, giving to everyone else, helping other people, and not, you know, looking after yourself, you're cutting off the head of the goose that's laid the golden eggs.
But you've got five golden eggs, though.
You've done all right.
I've done all right.
You know what? I'm not bothering. You know what?
Bully and Terry, I tell you what, people will be watching this going, Steve and Richie are narcissists, you can tell, can't you? Yeah. I've always thought.
I've said it a few times about you. Mate.
And if they are, you know, let me tell you, I'm so self-referencing, internally referenced, I don't give a carrot.
I don't give a fig, I say. Now, I have questions from people
Frankie
here.
Frankie Scarlett.
Which?
Is that true about the eggs, by the way, though?
All jokes aside, is that real? Where's the eggs?
Yeah, where's the eggs?
Wants to go straight on the Rob. Okay, here's a question for yous. How would it affect a child to be hyperbolically praised in a way that they won't believe? Overpraising of children, problem or not?
Is this the problem? Like a setup for future? Like bad? How's that?
I would say what can happen is that it's the, you know, the old thing. You know what, you're dead clever. You're really, really clever. God, you know, so intelligent, right? If that sets up a belief that I'm intelligent, then if I go into a situation where my intelligence may be put to the test, then I might say, I'll avoid that. Because I don't want to knock that belief, if that makes sense.
Right.
And there's been some research on this.
Yeah.
What's more useful is to say, for instance, to praise the child for working hard, for putting effort in.
Yes.
You know, you work hard. Yes. You get stuck in. You know, you keep going. You
so
keep going.
Praise the effort, not the results, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
What do you think, Steve?
Lots of different thoughts running through about that. I mean, I don't know if it would. What do you think? It would cause long-term effect. I pick up Terry's point. I think if it was creating a false sense of superiority or something like that, which could easily be rocked later, then that's almost a confusion setting in. Well, you know, I was always told I was really good, and now I'm being told by this teacher I'm not good or something. So I guess it's keeping it all more... And also, you know what, I'm maybe thinking, even young children soon realise when there's value in the praise or not. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's value in the praise, like Terry said, if you put your heart and soul into that piece of work, it's come out really good, you are really good at that, it connects at all the levels. It was just, if the kid knows how it didn't really do much, and the parents glowing over it, it's like, wow. So it can cause all sorts of things. It's a wide open question. I was trying to think about it in the terms of narcissistic abuse.
Well, in terms of that subject, you could argue that it could create a kind of narcissism light if the praise is laden with hyperbole.
Yeah.
It's based on no reality.
Yeah.
You're wonderful, based on no reality, no objective reality test.
Yeah.
You're breeding a kind of grandiose narcissistic entitlement.
Yeah.
This is the accusation that's leveled at millennials, he said, aware that everybody who is operating the cameras and the sound in the room is a millennial. Please don't kill me. Please don't stop filming. But it is the accusation that's leveled at millennials is that they were overpraised and therefore there isn't that resilience to sort of deal with being told, no, you can't do that. You don't actually have the capacity for that. Well, I was told I could do anything. Or the
entitlement issue.
So possibly the answer to the question would be, you know, maybe entitlement issues.
That's where I could sort of see that thing going, entitlement or false sense of ability, which could then easily be rocked. But actually, as false sense of ability, I mean, are we allowed to mention the Trump factor?
Yeah.
God knows what happened. I don't know. I've never read into his past or his childhood or something, but he just seems to think he is God.
Yeah.
And has no doubt.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt in his mind whatsoever. I'm not sure what the past is, but yes, he's been. Well, typically for an NPD to form, there would be massive trauma, massive loss, massive shame, coupled with totally overblown hyperbolic praising. That's you're right. Wonderful, you're a genius, you have the best, the biggest brain, so on and so
As
forth.
If you think about that, he does that. That's one of his, that's how he converses with a lot of people, isn't it? Yeah. You know, you know, this is the greatest guy here. This guy here is great, fantastic.
Hyperbole, yeah. Massive hyperbole, yeah.
How does he know?
Yeah, rather than just saying, hey, he's good. You know, what he does, based on this, he's good. Yeah. No, he's the best. He's the best. He's the greatest. Whatever.
Yeah, so, you know, but we're speculating a bit if that's where that could put.
I probably, she's the question behind the question is, with kids nowadays, there is a tendency towards hyperbolic praise and overpraising. I do think positive reinforcements is great.
Oh, that's it.
Bringing it back to like the martial arts, when I'm training people, you go, good, do it again, perfect, do it again, even if it's not perfect, because you need them to bang out a load of reps in order to get good.
Yeah.
So you want them to associate good feelings to banging out a load of reps. So you're like, yeah, great, good. But that's not, you wouldn't at the end of the session go, you are the best Muay Thai fighter I've ever seen.
He's gone into camp. Yeah.
You were counting down to when I'd go camp.
Camp Richard.
Let's go join Camp Richard. It's nudist camp, that one. All natural. And it's a Muay Thai camp. That's what brought it out, was the Muay Thai. Even the way I say Muay Thai is a bit camp.
It's a big camp, yeah. You say that when you're in a Muay Thai. So one thing though on that, which you mentioned, you're doing your little millennials bit.
Millennials.
When all the cameras went off, that point.
Yeah. The lights just got switched off. Get the fuck out of my studio. I'm not saying I think that.
And we
that's
finally
what
rolled
said.
The pixie filters over the top.
There's your final cut. You're going your tits.
But it's a big about not saying... Okay, it's a slightly different one, but not being able to say no to children.
Right.
You know, you're talking about hyperbolic praise,
well, it's the same
empty
thing.
Praise, but just not being able to say no. Well, creates a feeling of entitlement. I can have anything I ask for.
Because no is always a boundary, isn't it?
Yeah.
So a boundary is always a no. So if I'm giving you hyperbolic praise, I'm praising you with no boundaries. Yeah, so it still then becomes a boundary issue.
And I've heard this reason so many times, and I've sort of nearly fell into it myself many years ago in my mother. You know, I want to give them what I never had.
Right.
Which is nice, which is fine.
Yeah.
But then what I've seen this in personal experience, it's not just what you never had, it's more and more.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it's just so expected.
That's boundaryless too. It's boundaryless giving because you're not setting up a limit. And it's not, what people I think lose is kids don't really need material stuff. Give them what you never had in terms of guidance, in terms of support, in terms of being pushed, but you know, whatever. Don't
one
just
word,
give them more stuff.
Attention.
Attention, yeah.
Pure attention.
He always brings it back to Buddhism. This is what I like with Teddy. He's very Zen. What they need is attention. Bong.
You should have brought your singing bowl.
Singing bowl,
and a bong.
Well, you know, you may scoff, and I'm sure you will, right? But and I've said this before, but if you go back to Buddha psychology and the psychology of Buddhism, right? Not even talking about the spiritual aspect, but the psychology of all the contemporary therapies have pulled stuff out.
Oh yeah.
And that's NLP, CBT. Oh, yeah. Compassion-focused therapy,
absolutely,
acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yeah.
Put any three letters together, as long as it includes a T, you've got yourself a therapy.
Therapy. Yeah.
Well, the it's a goldmine, really. It's almost like, and I'm definitely not the first person to say this, the Zen tradition is like the inverse of psychotherapy in some respects. Psychotherapy is about, this is where it all goes wrong. We'll label all the things that go wrong. Yeah. Zen is, well, where's it right? How do we practice rightness?
Yeah.
How do we, you know, we're dissociating, we're stressed, we're depressed. Come into the moment, be present. Follow the Eightfold Noble Path, as Terry says. Somebody has asked me a question about feeling disgust when they're being pursued in an intimate context. What would you think that indicates if a client comes to you and says, somebody's trying to pursue me to be a boyfriend, to be a girlfriend, intimate context, I am disgusted. What would you be looking for? What avenue would you pursue?
Again, lots of different contexts there. It would depend on what I've heard before, what it's all around.
Mm.
But again, this disgust is another one of those words, isn't
it's
it?
It's a label.
It's a label. It doesn't exist. It's a in LP, we call it a normalization.
Can you put it in a wheelbarrow?
Yeah. A shelf, I say. Can you get a box of disgust off the shelf? You know?
Top shelf.
Top shelf.
Yes, you can.
Don't have many attacks.
I want me.
I have disgust. And, I'll take a shame, please.
Nice box of shame.
Monthly shame. Yeah. Oh, lovely.
I did make the mistake of saying, can you get a box of happy? I went, yeah, I can get a bag of happy. Okay, fine. Moving right along.
So disgust, yeah, disgust, they're being pursued. They feel disgust. So go on, what you said.
What are the, you know, how is it manifesting itself behaviourally? Right. So what are they doing? Mm. How are they disgusting?
Okay. Yeah,
I don't mean disgusting. Yeah. But
how are they verbifying their disgust?
How are they doing disgust?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
How are they doing disgust? Yeah.
You know?
Like the victim, the target.
And that will usually uncover beliefs, that will usually uncover, you know?
Yes, back through beliefs.
Then we can
it?
Go back and sort of, okay, start questioning those beliefs.
Is there potentially an avenue of exploration in terms of emotional literacy where they're saying, I feel disgust?
Oh, yeah.
And then you break it down and you go, it's not really disgust, is it? It's fear.
How do you know it's disgust?
It's guilt, it's shame. Yeah. How do you know it's disgust? Could it be other emotions?
Yes.
Is there any other words we can give this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because that's like a heuristic sort of thing, isn't it? It's just
emotional literacy.
I feel disgust. Yeah.
Sorry. Emotional literacy is gold dust.
Thank you.
Gold dust.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think it's brilliant.
Did I tell you the comments I had recently of clients who said, this man's a genius, they said, because of these.
Very intelligent.
Yeah, I'm getting
client.
A little bit fed up with it now, are you? Richie this.
It's his fawning response. Like,
oh, yeah.
No,
he's such a fawning.
I think when it's accurate, it's fair. It's not boundless praise.
See, it's overpraise.
It's not. It's accurate praise based on objective facts. I am a genius. The emotional literacy came out of my own experience because of finding myself back in therapy, depressed. Yeah. And I'll be like, oh, feel like shit. And then going through with a counsellor and I'm going, well, what does feel like shit mean?
Yeah.
And I couldn't break down further that my emotional scale was angry, sad, happy, hungry.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not good. That's like primeval caveman shit. There's more that you're feeling. And then through accessing what I was feeling, going, this actually really helps.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a quality of consciousness changer on a level of meditation. When I used to do Zen meditation when I was a kid, you're in Zen meditation. That means you know Terry Ezra.
Yeah. At least Aikido.
One of the highly ranked Westerners in the world for Aikido. Yeah, I used to do Zen with him.
Yeah.
And that you know, when you finish Zen, a good session, and you walk away and everything is clear and everything is calm and everything is still and you just are seeing the world as it is. That's the similar effect I got from doing emotional literacy type exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I pushed it out. Because I think the trauma makes you emotionally illiterate.
Mm.
You just go, ugh, everything is yuck. So let's just push away from the emotion altogether.
I think a lot of people, even outside of trauma, I think a lot of people are emotionally illiterate.
Absolutely.
To a degree.
Yeah.
You know, it's either, you know, I feel bad, I feel good, you know what? And there's no sort of thousand.
There's no nuance.
There's no nuance. That's the word I was looking for.
I mean, it gets worse than that sometimes. If there is a worse, it's just, no, you said I feel, whatever. I just feel bad. You know, people say I feel angry, but then there's the ones who say I am angry.
Yeah,
and that's the one I always hear that in a like alarm bells. I am angry because that's their definition of them, isn't it? You know, I'm angry.
I think it might be unique to
identity level.
Yeah, but even, you know, go on, might be unique.
I was going to say it's unique to English, but it's not. But English is one of the languages where instead of saying, I feel, or I'm doing, or I'm in a state of, you are the emotion. There are other languages that do it as well.
Yeah. Well, on the emotional literacy, which I'm a big fan of as well, it's a really good piece of work, I do see an opportunity, and try to balance this opportunity of, okay, we're talking about a label, let's say disgust.
Mm.
And then you can, there's a bit of a fork in the road and it's how you balance this. Mm. This is my theory. Mm. This is my theory.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, let's explore disgust.
Mm.
Let's go deep into disgust. What's underneath disgust? It's sad and anger. Mm. And down that rabbit hole,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not saying you don't do, but I'm saying then you're spending your time reinforcing all the thoughts, feelings. Say, I told you it was disgust. Now I'm even more disgusted.
Yeah, yeah. Now we've expanded it.
Or you take it the other way. And I'll just repeat for the last time, I'll repeat. I'm not saying one is right, one is wrong, but it's about a bit of a balance, isn't it? About them. What would you rather be feeling instead of disgust?
Yeah.
And let's open up that way. You know, in this situation, what would you rather feel instead of disgust? And if it was like, well, whatever they say, it's what they say, their labels. Well, you know, assertive and calm and able to deal with it. Okay, and how would that feel? So you open up another path of different emotional behaviours.
And by inverting the question and inverting the question, forcing an answer from them, you're actually pushing the brain in an area that it has not gone to, does not want to go to.
Yes.
Because it's happy and it's suffering. Yeah. It's happy locked in the prison of distress.
That's right.
And you're going, out you fucking go. Into the cold, we'll get an answer out of you one way or another. What would you rather be feeling in the context of intimacy, somebody's pursuing you?
Yeah.
They'll be like, well, I don't, not disgust. No, we're not letting you get away with that.
That's the blue elephant.
Yeah, you've got to say what you'd rather be feeling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would you rather be excited, full of anticipation, you know, whatever it is? And because then that will do just as good a job of telling us what the disgust really is.
Yeah, it is. But that's why I think it's a balance. You know, I think I don't dismiss that. What is the disgust? But I'd probably go 20% that way and 80%.
Yeah.
What's better than disgust? What would be a better state to be in? And that doesn't mean to say in this relationship question that you should just all of a sudden say, okay, yeah, I'm going to be receptive then.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that. It just means
the brain would reject that command anyway, wouldn't it? It would just go no.
But you want to get to a place where you say, okay, well, the word I'm coming up with is I'm assertive enough to deal with it now, rather than just feeling disgust.
Yeah,
I'm assertive, and again, it comes back to I'm always intrigued by how people know that they feel disgust. How do you know? Where does that happen? How does it? Yeah.
Well, that ties into what I just want to say. Actually, I mean, when they say disgust, there's obviously. To have disgust is not disgust. You know, not disgust. You know, what are they measuring it against? Whose standards? You know, because you could feel disgust.
Tell me how to feel disgusted. Good. Yeah, tell me what I need to do.
Yeah, the old NLP thing. Yeah. And that's a pretty useful way of picking it apart because they're assuming that that's the right way. You know, for instance, in a relationship. Some people might say, well, I'm not doing that, it's disgusting. But other people might go, oh, great.
It sounds like a good night, isn't it? Yes, love. I'm glad that you suggested it because I was too embarrassed to. cancel all my appointments for the next 6 hours.
Somebody asked us a question here, so they might be at some point watching this and saying, the fuck are these on about?
I have a good follow-up question.
But it is true, though, isn't it? You know, so find out how they come to that decision.
That they're feeling disgust.
Yeah, you know, what are they comparing it to? Who, for instance, guilt and shame.
Yeah.
For instance, okay, where did you learn that? Who taught you that?
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know? Because there are certain things that, some person might put a few pounds on it because they're on a weight loss plan and they put a few pounds on because they fall off the wagon. They feel ashamed. Yeah. Another person might do exactly the same thing and go, do you know what?
No big deal.
I'll just get back on the wagon and, different.
But then
it's the language thing, which I'm very hot on, the way people talk to themselves. That, I mean, and I suspect we all do it, but I clarify is I'm looking for the effect of their language on themselves, like their communication on themselves, and that's where your work, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Is there to bring it back to the person who's actually asked the question? There is the most obvious elephant in the room, which we've skipped past, probably because it's obvious to us. It's likely that there is a core belief there.
Yeah.
I'm not lovable.
Yeah.
Don't love me. I'm disgusting.
Yeah.
Where's the disgust coming from? Oh, I feel disgust because you're trying to love me.
Yeah.
No, I'm disgusting. Is probably, would you say that it's likely that's a core belief that's running?
Oh, no, I am disgusting.
I am disgusting.
Okay. No, it's toughy, isn't it, to answer that one?
Core belief.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a core belief and a belief? You know, the beliefs, the not, you know, the fluffy words again, the set of behaviours that we group in and as a result, form a belief.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Just to answer that, because it might help the person who's asked the question, a core belief would be probably non-conscious. So if I go, you think you're disgusting. You go, no, I don't.
Yeah.
I go, well, let's look at your behaviours and what you've just told me about people. Do you think it's possible that somebody who's running your behaviours and talking the way you're talking might have some self-worth issues or, you know?
Yeah.
Again, I have this sort of thing about language, right? Mm. The deep unconscious core beliefs.
Mm.
You know, the way they talk to themselves, like, you know, it's embedded.
Mm.
It's not embedded. You know, you don't have a deep unconscious. You have an unconscious and a conscious.
Mm.
Conscious, you know, neither of them exist as things.
Mm-hmm.
They're labels we put on processes, you know? Like now I'm conscious, you know, I'm listening to you, I'm conscious of Steve here and the light behind you.
Mm-hmm.
There's many things I'm not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
That's all, right?
Mm.
Like the deep structure, surface structure in NLP.
You disgust me.
Good.
We were discussing you before you came. You were discussed. So what we could say to her that would potentially be useful, explore beliefs. Explore how you feel. Explore what it is you do want to feel instead of that.
Yeah.
Look at the language that you use.
Counter examples to the belief you want to
alter.
Alter.
Yeah.
There would be a different thing. You know, what is it about this pursuit that causes that feeling of disgust? Triggers it in some way. You know.
Yeah.
Is it? And again, just going off on a ramble about it, I guess, but is it because of them they feel they're unlovable and therefore disgusted? Or is there something about the behaviour of the pursuer, the way he's doing it? Great. You know, if he's knocking on the door...
Yeah, I didn't think of that.
Naked. That's disgusting.
Mm. Oh, shit. Is that... I've been doing it wrong. That's why I'm single. I thought that was the way.
I'm dead. Yeah. Hiya. Oh, no.
Sam.
Wrong house.
Sorry. 47. Thought it was 49. Yeah, sorry, love.
Tell your mum it's all right.
Okay, let's take a break there for a sec. That's a good place to stop. I need to eat some... I brought protein. I'm absolutely starving. I'm dying. I've got a protein shake with me.
Did you just bring one for yourself, yeah?
Yeah, just for me.
Can you move your head either there or there? Because all I can see is like a...
What do you want? Which way do you want?
Is it the light's right, just right in there.
The light's in the way?
Yeah.
Well, he's just put me in shot.
Has he?
Yeah.
Do you need to be in shot?
I do need to be in shot. I'm very important. Tell you what. Narcissistic injury inflicted. Expect my revenge. I've just realised as we were talking, I've got these because I get my eyes get tired after reading. And so at the middle distance, after working, I can't see things clearly. But it really, as I'm looking at you two, it really makes a big difference. What did you think of the Khabib-McGregor fight?
The fight?
Yeah, good. The fight was good.
I've
seen the aftermath.
The aftermath was appalling. Terrible, isn't it?
Absolutely appalling, yeah, I know.
Did you predict it going that way?
I thought Khabib would win.
Yeah.
Do you mean the fight bit?
The actual fight, yeah.
I thought, I hoped.
Yeah, you wanted him to battle McGregor, yeah.
I did. He's a better fighter than McGregor, I think. Yeah. But so I was quite, quite pleased with it. Then everybody's let themselves down, haven't they? You know, Khabib's going to come out of this badly.
Oh yeah.
He'll probably lose his belt and might even lose the purse on that fight. You know,
the reason come out why it happened.
Yes, the war of words went way too far. Conor likes to get inside of people's heads. And he plays a good psychological game.
He does do that.
And he does it very well. But he started talking about, and I don't, this is an area that I'm not familiar with at all. There was something to do between Chechnya and Dagestan is the country, which I couldn't even point to on a map. And there was a trainer from one country and he took instructions. One of Khabib's guys did, and he called him a traitor. And he said a Chechen man would never take instructions from it. And you're like, whoa. You're getting into a bit of ethnic and religious and political stuff there, Conor. Maybe just leave that alone. He lost the plot. I predicted that he'd beat him up for three rounds and choke him. Yeah. I've only seen clips. Beat him up, mauled him for three rounds, and then neck cranked him. Just to be really nasty. Yeah. Just to really just lay a beating on him, because that's contempt, isn't it? You know, I'm not even going to back, I'm going to crank your head for you. But
There is a whole story which I've not bothered about going into. I've seen the headlines that but in that area of where did you say it was the other country?
Dagestan.
No, the other one.
Chechnya.
Chechnya.
Yeah.
And the guy, the head of the Chechnya, he's a criminal, bad guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
But so they reckon he is in that whole area. The guy who's head of Chechnya, I can't remember his name, he makes a thing out of befriending famous combat. He's had Tyson over there and everything.
Oh, yes. I've been on his air. I stopped doing it because I realised it wasn't that funny. I used to think it was funny. I'd follow and comment on him because, he's big on MMA, big on boxing, and I found out his backstory and why he's in, why he's been put in the position he's in Chechnya. Yeah. And that's not funny at all. Yeah. That was like, I'm going to unfollow this. I'm going to, you know, it's not, it's nasty. Nasty stuff. Nasty
it's
stuff.
Just a pity Khabib couldn't just have held his... But you see, did you see the in the last minutes of the fight, the last minutes of the fight, the microphone actually picks up McGregor saying, he's like getting choked. It's only business.
Is that what he said? Yeah. It's only business.
Yeah. I mean, to say, you know, all that wind up, and so everybody's, when that quote has been seen as absolutely honest.
Yeah.
It's McGregor saying, all the wind up is about generating bums on seats and revenue. Absolutely. It's only business. But Khabib overreacted and took it as a slight on his family and his religion and his country and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah. So, I would have stayed away from fathers, countries, and religion.
Yeah,
I'd take the piss out of his hat.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all right.
That's sheep on his head.
That's sheep on his head. He would have dealt with that. But anything else?
He got the desired response, though, didn't he?
What, by getting battered?
No, by triggering. He wanted to trigger him.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's his name? Khabib.
Khabib. Right. Don't ask me to say his surname.
No.
He reacted perfectly, given what his background is, given his personal history.
Mm.
And if you map that across to what we're talking about,
right?
When other people are triggered, when our clients are triggered, they're reacting perfectly, given what's gone before.
An expert manipulator has pushed the buttons on them, absolutely.
They know that, And you know, even now, for instance, why do I keep doing this? You know, I know what I should do, but I keep doing this. Well, great, you're reacting perfectly given what's gone before. So don't give yourself a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, if you'd have had a different personal history, you wouldn't react in a particular way.
So when people are asking questions about protecting themselves for the future, maybe one thing to do would be to say, don't be such a perfect mark. You're too predictable. I mean, I find myself saying that to clients all the time. You're too good. And I don't mean, you're such a good person. I mean, you're too good. Predictable, you're moral, you're clear, you're honest. They're sending me like their interactions with the ex, and they'll go, "What do you think of that?" And I'll go, "You've just told your ex, who you've identified, he's a narcissistic psychopath. You've told him where you are, what you're thinking, how sad you are, why you're sad. It's all ammunition.
Yes.
You don't give the enemy all this valuable information about your weaknesses and the potential targets. You hide that from the enemy. There's still." And it's sad, you know, it's still the malignant... I've done it. Anybody who's been involved in narcissistic abusive relationship has done it. It's that malignant optimism. You know, you think, I'll fawn, I'll give them this, and then they'll start being nice.
I'll explain why, but that gives them all that information, absolutely.
Yeah, gives them more of the stuff. So, yeah, you're right, there is that.
I was also coming from the viewpoint of, you know, don't be guilty. Don't feel guilty. Don't feel ashamed of what's happened, because you couldn't have done it any other way, given what you've... your personal history's been.
Yes.
If you could have, you know, and I explain further when I make, it's not, well, if you could have, you would have. I don't mean that as a slight. Mm. You know, if you had the resources, you would have done something else.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
But if you want, again, the stories we tell, isn't it? You know, if you go to see an expert, like a lawyer, architect, brain surgeon, you want them to be experts at their job, and you want them to tell you stuff that you don't know, and you want to behave and follow what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And expert manipulators are equally as qualified.
Yeah.
And narcissistic or any manipulator, consider them to be as qualified as a brain surgeon.
Yeah.
They know stuff you don't.
Yeah.
There's another point to pick up there. Again, that guy, Khabib.
Khabib. You can call him Khabib.
Yeah.
What's he going to do? Yeah. What are you going to do? Habib.
Yeah.
It's it. And he's a lightweight. Fluffy fucking hat.
He's a lightweight.
Well,
Now, he'll be calling me like, "You, where are you? I come to see you. You don't make joke about me. I come see you now."
Do you know what the Chechen dialing code is? Because if you see it come up on your phone, mate, don't answer.
Do you know what the Chechen for, "Please don't kill me, brother," is?
That's the other thing, you know, the fight, flight, fawn. The fawning is fine. You could do...
Actually, this is universal in any language, isn't it?
Don't kill me. Don't kill me.
I have kids.
Tears are quite good as well.
I cry. Real ones You'll not good. Kill. I am very scared. Because I'm from Kazakhstan now. Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
This guy.
Khabib.
Okay.
Get with the story, mate. Come on.
You know, we were talking about he couldn't have reacted any other way, given what's gone before.
Yeah.
Right? If McGregor had said the same thing to you, or you, or any of our clients, don't know about clients, we'd have gone, because didn't have the same meaning, you know? I'm going back to language. Mm. It's not the words that cause the problem, it's how you, the meaning you give it.
Right.
Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Do you remember Roadhouse, a film called Roadhouse?
I do.
Right? There's a, and I use it as an example sometimes. You know, Patrick Swayze, he's the cooler, isn't he? He's the guy, you know, he's the doorman. And all the other doormen are sort of sitting around him going, well, what, you know, what happens if things get out of hand? And he's going through, his monologue, and he goes, well, if someone gets in your face, be nice. If someone, upset you, be nice, until it's time not to be nice. And he says, one of the fellas who turns out to be a bad, he says, what if he calls my mother a whore? And he goes, is she? And you can see him going, he said, it's just two words string in a particular order to create a particular response. So it's like reaction seeking communication, if you put yourself at effect, you're going to get the reaction. You put yourself at cause, you can choose not to react in a particular way. This is why I made a note here about being triggered. I've got a thing about this word triggered.
Is it a trigger for you? How does it make you feel?
I respond to that word triggered, right? So if we see...
Voluntarily? I'm a prick, aren't I? That's why nobody wants coaching from me
occasionally.
Anymore.
What, occasionally?
Not all the time.
Oh, no. Okay.
No, I am all the time.
What's triggered? Was it Trigger the Wonder
No,
Horse?
See, you can't even get it right, can you? It was the Lone Ranger's horse, wasn't it?
Trigger.
Okay. Yeah.
So what have you got against the Lone Ranger?
I can see through his mask.
So can he.
So
otherwise it would be a blindfold.
Listen,
you said, stop me when it's getting daft. I think that's the line. When I said, so can he, I immediately felt guilt and shame, and I was like,
can we crack on with this? Because I'm going away in November.
Yeah. No, absolutely, Terry. I'm sorry that we're stopping you from telling your story. Please carry on.
It's not a story, it's an observation.
Okay.
Yeah, right. if you put yourself on the other side, be a cause rather than effect. That trigger. You know what I mean about triggered. Triggered implies that you've got no choice.
Yes.
I'm being triggered. Well, I hear it all the time. Not from just clients in our context.
Yeah.
But even my personal clients, always triggering me, or she's triggering me,
in the culture now.
Yes,
that's a good point. Because it's an easy thing to say. I'm being triggered. It's like saying, oh, well, there I am. Learned helplessness.
No, it's
do what you will.
Okay. Eventually, I got your point. Eventually.
I mean, when he made it.
Yeah.
Which took some time.
And it's a good point.
Well, I just like the lead, you see.
You give a lot of foreplay. A lot. Which is a good tactic, because by the time we're ready to go, I'm like, just give it to me, Terry. Just fucking go on. And then I'm grateful.
Do you know what one of my clients said? She said,
stop recording. she said, that was the best session I have had in a long time.
It was the word foreplay that just triggered him, though.
I was telling her about what we're doing today, and she said, yeah, well, hopefully, I love those things, but hopefully you can cut out the bit where you three are just banging on. and get straight to the, you know, bits, like, you know, okay, that's fine. Like,
guilt and shame. I was telling him, don't worry, people love it when we have a laugh and a joke. And he was like, no, it's too much, you know.
I
know,
keep it sensible. They love it, they love it. So the word triggered has become a bit too thrown around now. And people are saying,
And of course, it absolves responsibility. When you take account, you know, when you make yourself accountable,
I've been triggered, like, I can't do anything about it. It's not me, it's been triggered. I've been triggered, yeah.
If somebody's in that mindset, what would you normally recommend? As an alternative?
Depends on. Well, I teach them a model. Trigger or cue, now, routine, result, right? So you've got the cue, right? This is where I think mindfulness, you know, is a really, really powerful therapeutic tool for anxiety and whatever, right? Cue, the pattern. So how do you do anxiety? So for instance, the cue, I hear something, or I see a text, or I see an email from a certain person.
Oh, cue as in C-U-E.
Yeah. Not like a cue of people.
Yeah.
Because that would be silly.
Okay.
That would just be crazy.
I went with the letter Q.
I went with letter Q.
It's going to, you know.
I'm sorry. Go on.
What is this?
Go on.
Keep going.
The floor is yours.
Will Flannel and, you know, whatever.
Will Flannel?
Will Flannel?
Will Ferrell.
He is.
Carry on.
Right. So the Q.
Yeah.
You know, which is what, you know, what we might know as the trigger before this cue. Yeah. Then we got the routine. So I see the email, and, you know, and I ask them, okay, so what's the very next thing you do?
Yeah.
Well, it might be, and it's pulling out the unconscious, the unconscious process.
NLP would be like a strategy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You've gone through a strategy. The word strategy. That
see, feel, or hear some certain ways.
Well, I like it. It's easy. Just trigger, cue, routine, result.
Yeah.
Right. So. See the email, hear, see, feel something.
Mm.
As a result, I get anxiety. That's the result, right?
Yeah.
So, and there are numerous ways of getting to, you know, heading it off at the pass, if you like, is putting an intervention before the trigger, you know, which could be psychoeducation, you know, how these things work. Mm-hmm. Even the self-awareness of how these things work is useful, right? Or on the trigger itself, which I quite, you know, think is quite useful, right? It's creating that gap between the trigger and the routine.
Yeah.
In that gap,
you've
got the change space.
The choice
to do something else.
That's good.
Right? And that's where neuroplasticity comes in. Yeah. So the easy thing is to fly off the handle, because I've done it so many times. Mm. The brain goes, oh, we know this one, don't we? See the email.
Oh, yeah. Respond.
Feel like shit.
Yeah.
Right? So see the email, okay, start to feel like shit. Okay, what do I need to do? Do something else, whether it's anything. Go for a glass of water, do something else, anything else.
Mm.
Yeah. And over time, as you know, that becomes the conditioned response.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes the pathway. And to use the analogy of a forest, the more you use that pathway, the clearer it gets.
The road less traveled.
The road less traveled becomes the road more traveled.
And then a motorway.
And then, what do you think happens to the one that you've always gone down? You know, it was a path, right, that you stopped using any. Stop using, what happens? It gets overgrown.
Yeah.
It's still there, you're not taking away choice, but it's just doing the right thing.
Yeah, the brain's going to choose the more effective way of getting the job done, isn't it?
Yeah,
if it realizes it doesn't need to do that anymore, it'll go, well,
this is better.
This is easier. One thing about that is, it's, you know, that can be built up over a long period of time. I mean, it could be a traumatic one-time learning, couldn't it?
But absolutely.
A lot of times, it's been built up over a persistent period of time. And so it's a default. And so it's really hard to break out that default. It's like, I can get it intellectually. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. You try trying to break out of it, though. That's the toughie, isn't it?
Well,
you've got to be, I think the word is persistence again. You've got to be persistent then about.
Persistent and even though consistent. That's why in the course, we're giving them exercises. The course is intense and it's slightly traumatic.
Absolutely. It's a boot camp type thing.
It's a boot camp type thing, and they have to do things in their own time, 3 times a day.
Yep.
And that's really to create that neuroplasticity and to lay down new neural pathways. Drill the skill.
In your little model there, though, the cue,
routine
results, that reminds me similarly, and you'll know better than me because I think you've done a lot of, it's the CBT way of looking at it. But the belief comes in, isn't it? The cue or the activating of events, whatever you call it. Yeah. Then the belief is boom in there as well.
Okay, so I actually do it the other way. So what's the activating event?
Yes.
What are the consequences?
Seeing the emails, right. Activating events, believing it's going to be.
Okay. Yeah. What in order for that consequence to be the right thing to have happened?
Yeah.
The only thing to have happened really.
Yeah.
You know, makes sense. What are you believing about?
Yeah.
What are you believing about the person who sent you the email, for instance? Yeah. What do you believe about the world? What do you believe about the, you know, others?
Then you can challenge and dispute that belief.
Yeah.
Because it is that, you know, it's not impossible for your change to happen instantaneously, but it's more likely to be through it's the rewiring is what we've talked about, the neuroplasticity. You've got to be able to do a bit of remapping. If we could just lift the lid, change the plugins and close it down again, it'd be great. But we've got to use like conversations and exercise and their own imaginations. Go, there is a different pathway. And they're off that way.
An important point here, because I've got this on more than one occasion, because they've been in a particular mindset for 40-odd years or 30-odd years, you know, they think, they get the neuroplasticity side, is it going to take 40 years to work? No. It could happen like that, bam, you know? We know this, you know, if the change has got enough emotional impact to it, or you put enough motivational juice in the change.
No, that's a good point.
Then it's going to be. It's going to take a lot less than 42 years. Put it that way, you know.
But it's persistent this time.
But then,
it's been persistent 42 years, persistently getting here.
Doing it right.
But that's been unconscious, and I hesitate to use that word, but not a conscious decision. Now you said sod this, that next piece of consciousness is persistent and should be short, and not 42 years, you know, but otherwise we wouldn't have enough time to get where we want to be.
And the conscious part.
If it's right, it won't take longer than 14 days.
No, it can't.
Yeah. I mean, if it took longer than 14 days, I'd be going, you're just doing it wrong.
14 days, for me, consistent, though.
Yeah,
it takes how long it takes, right? But nowhere near, you know, what they've gone through. You know, it could take 14 days. I mean, if you look at the research, right? The old cliche that's trotted out, it takes 21 days to change a habit.
They say
it doesn't.
They say,
you know, that comes from cybernetics.
I was going to say it's a sales book from the 70s, but maybe it was psycho-cybernetics.
They got it
first.
From psycho-cybernetics.
Maxwell Maltz.
Yeah. And that was based on one woman who looked herself in the mirror after a nose surgery and still didn't see.
Still felt ugly.
Still felt ugly. That's right,
Yeah, that's right.
But then the latest bit of research...
If it works for people, leave it.
But it could take a lot less time.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like if you spend all your life, I know you don't, driving in England.
Passive aggressive.
I don't spend all my life...
doesn't drive.
Driving. Well, see, here's the thing.
And then you go abroad.
20 years.
And you drive on the other side of the road.
20 years ago,
yeah.
I tried it, and I thought, this is just fucking stressful.
Driving?
Yeah. I didn't enjoy it one bit. I thought, no, I have this thing. If it's stressful and you don't need it or want it, get rid of it.
Even though the consequences are massively beneficial.
Well, it depends. You see, if you think about the consequences, then that's part of the do we need it or do we want it?
Anyway, you go to the States and you drive on the other side of the road. 48 hours, it's normal, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's just like an analogy. Clapping.
No, will you remember? Okay, if you do the... You clash your hands like this.
If your left thumb's over the top...
Are you left-thumbed or you're right-thumbed?
So what does that mean? If your left thumb's over the top.
Okay, so then do this.
Yeah.
Again, do this.
Yeah.
Do this.
Yeah.
Do this. Does the opposite one become feel a little bit more comfortable now?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like that. You see.
But if they say if you do it like that and your default is left over right, that means you're a more sexually attractive person. If your default is right over left, it means you're more intellectual.
Right.
And there are some people who just put them together. They just think about sex a lot.
I like that. It was worth the wait.
Very good.
Now, you were going along. We were talking about people saying that they're being triggered. And it, yeah. it felt like you were going along towards, be careful of that chair, it's got it in for you. The root of the belief, you said, you were saying there's the cue or the trigger, okay. the stimulus, and then the belief and then the reaction.
Yeah.
Where you were about to go to, you have to believe that you have no control over your reaction in order for this to be a thing.
I wasn't going there, no.
Do you think that that's a thing? Allow me to set you up
well,
for this question.
Because I wasn't going there. Run it by me again. Go on.
In order to sort of say, to absolve yourself of personal responsibility and yeah. turn the locus of control from internal to external, do you need to believe I don't have a control? Like if you say a certain word to me, I'm guaranteed yeah. to feel this.
Yeah.
That externalizing of locus of control, that means the person's open to narcissistic abuse, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
because course, yeah. because they're going, well, I don't control how I feel. The external world controls how I feel. I want to paraphrase and butcher a misattributed quote that was attributed to Bruce Lee, something like, the reasonable man adapts himself to suit the environment. The unreasonable man adapts the environment to suit himself.
Yeah.
There seems to be this phase culturally we've gone into of the demand that the environment match my specific yeah. internal desires yeah. or... shit fit,
yeah. Yeah.
or, you know, appeal to authority, or protest, or, you know.
It's a recipe for anxiety and depression, you name it.
Is that why we're seeing such broad-scale anxiety and depression?
I would say so. Yeah. You know, hang on. It should be like this, going back to Buddhist psychology again, right? Piece it again. Present state, desired state. Mm. This is for want of a better expression, reality.
Mm.
But it should be like this.
Yeah.
This is the way he is, or she is. But he should be like that, or she should be like that.
Should be.
Yeah, the shoulds. The oughts,
yeah.
the musts, and all this. That's what causes the suffering, the anxiety. Yeah, right? When you accept...
Your internal map is not being met by reality, by yeah. external map. Yeah. That's the anxiety, isn't it? Yeah.
You know? Comes back to my, you know... where I work with all my clients. Don't just start from where you are. Doesn't matter what you know, what's gone before, just start from where you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds like a leading towards the more stoic and Zen-like philosophy. You must accept it as
what
it is.
What can you control? Yeah. What can't you control?
Without the story, can you accept things as they are without telling a story, without having a no to what is, without saying no to the existence of that reality? I have one more question. Get your flipping glasses on, lad.
Let's
tell you what. Right. This is a good one. I don't think we've ever discussed this, and I'll read it exactly as they wrote it. It is, how does hypnosis work with a person's past trauma and abuse? We never really talk about hypnosis or hypnotherapy. We're all qualified in it, and we all use it, I think, to a degree, but we've never really sort of discussed what we're all individually doing with it.
The first thing I would say... is what is their perception of hypnosis? Mm-hmm. Is it what they've seen on the TV?
Mm.
What they've seen Paul McKenna?
Mm.
You know? And I'll more or less like guarantee it's going to be something like that. You know? For instance, do I lose control? Am I aware? Might or you know, I when someone talks to me about hypnosis in any of the sessions, I go through all these myths, right? Even to the point of saying, well, you didn't attract. What is a trance? Right? Mm. It's just a focused state of awareness.
Yeah.
Right? You're in one already.
Yeah.
Mm. We're in three trances now. Yeah. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, six people in this room. It's six trances because of our own personal filtering system. Right? If that person's talking about her version of hypnosis, would it help with trauma? There'd be a lot of work before I'd do that. And it wouldn't be looking to the eyes, you know, it would be conversational, you know.
Conversational hypnosis.
It's easier, right? We do it all the time.
Oh, but humans are doing it to each other every minute of the day. Absolutely, you are putting people into trances. Yeah.
So as far as, I think we're all using the same definition of hypnosis, it's more of a neuro-linguistic programming version, anti-myth, because there are people who use more theatrical hypnosis and they do the watch, the thing with the watch and lie down, I'll count you down into a trance and then
I'll
we'll
use
do stuff.
That if that's what I think the person wants, because it's the, you know, oh, well, I want to be, you know.
Satisfies their need at that time.
Like, I mean, I get people saying to me, can you hypnotize me to stop X, Y, Z, right? Well, how do you know what hypnosis you need? Mm. And if I can stop you doing X, Y, and Z without hypnosis, is that
would
okay?
Would you feel unsatisfied, yeah. cheated Would that be okay?
Yeah. But most of the time, they're saying, yeah, fine, yeah.
Yeah.
So, because we all come up with our, you know, we come into it with our expectations.
Yeah.
Preconceived, you know.
Yeah.
When, would you use, would, if somebody came to you with any trauma at all, violent incident, abusive relationship, would, is that the thing you would reach for in the toolkit, hypnosis?
So I think we all would say, no.
Mm.
And then do it. Mm. Because that's what we do. We know that the tool to get into somebody's brain, thoughts, and rest of it is something, hypnosis, some flavour of hypnosis. It's language, it's conversation. Mm. It's getting them to, you talk to them, they make an image in their mind, that image in their mind maybe alters the way they're thinking. Mm. So it's not, as Teddy was just saying, it's not, you know, look into my eyes, look into my eyes. It's just, let me just explore for a minute. You know, if I was to, I'm not sure if this is the right question to ask you, but if I asked you about the possibility, and they go, well, yeah, that's a possibility, and boom.
Yeah.
So it is a technique, and it is hypnosis, but you don't sort of go looking in your back, oh, hypnosis, and use that.
Yeah.
You just use what's, but then by, you know, by the next minute, you might be using a slightly different tool, which might be called from the NLP book or something. Mm. So you weave in and out of whatever the client responds to and needs
you,
to.
You rip the labels off whatever toolbox we've got, and it just whatever the client needs at that time is applicable. I was going to mention, you know, I do, you know, me and my stories.
Mm. Tell us a story.
Well, you know, stories are hypnosis.
Yeah.
Yes, they are, in a sense.
Because they're usually metaphors. They have embedded commands in them, and they teach you something.
Yeah.
Well, and just the metaphor in and of itself, a story, right? Rather than the direct suggestion of...
Oh, did they have a four joke this time?
It's died on its ass five times, and he's still trying to do it.
He's persistent.
He's persistent.
That's his resilience coming through.
He's consistent. He hammers away.
Mm. Oh, hammers away. Hammers away.
Thank you.
Milton Erickson.
Milton Erickson.
He was all metaphor, wasn't he?
It's all metaphor. You know? And this is where, you know, people ask a question, and I'll go, do I give you the 45-minute seminar with the whiteboard on what it is you're actually... Because you don't... You're using a word... And you don't really, and I think this is the thing with, one of the great things with NLP. I've never met somebody who's trained in NLP who adheres to the other version of what hypnosis is, who doesn't accept conversational hypnosis as a real thing, never. The Ericksonian way is through metaphor, through talking. Bandler and Grinder were users of conversational hypnosis. And it's, so when somebody says, would you use hypnosis? Like you said, do you mean the film version where you sit down and then go and do this? You're the Manchurian candidate.
Yeah.
I mean...
There's also an element of, it's a quick fix. Mm. I used to hypnotize you to stop doing it like that before.
Yes.
Just hypnotize you to stop doing it. Well, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Unless it does.
But
somebody says, you hypnotize me to stop smoking, you go, yeah, come here.
Yeah.
Come here. Yeah. Boom, stop smoking.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Done. Right.
Enough. Well, that's the odd thing with hypnosis, and I don't think, actually, that I use it enough. And I don't think we use it enough, really, because sometimes it's not the quick fix the client thinks it is, but from the coach's point of view, it's a quicker fix than a lot of other things. Relax, listen, open up, think about this, now think about this. Can you imagine how it would feel if you felt that way? Now go deeper, think about this. Imagine, we're talking about changing neural pathways. It's probably... the fastest way of doing it, daydreaming, guided daydreaming.
I made a note here because guided daydream, for instance, because it was a question that's come up a few times that thought might be useful to address.
Mm.
Clients who have nightmares.
Right.
You know? Well, what's a nightmare? It's a bad dream. It's a dream.
Mm.
But because of its nature, its content, and the upsetting nature, we label it a nightmare, right? You know? And you wake up and then all night sweats. So one of the things I came across, this came out of something I did
about 3 or 4 years ago. Without going into the content, I will. Right. She had an accident, right? Mm. And this car sort of went over the back of her heel, and she was pushing the baby in a pram, and she pushed the baby out the way, right? The car went over her ankle, right? Mm. So the recurring nightmare was she couldn't save a baby, right? Mm-hmm. And she'd have nightmares of, being in the bath with the baby and the baby's drowning. And so it was as simple as, okay, put it up on the screen there, right? Okay, I want you to re-script there. I want you to run it the way you want it to run. And she ran it and ran it and ran it. We for 20 minutes, we ran it, right? And it stopped.
Yeah.
Right? Now, the other part of it was, which is really, really useful, as well, as soon as you wake up, and I've tried this with a few clients and they said it's worked. As soon as you wake up, what do we do when we wake up? We generally move, don't we? As soon as we move. So if you have a nightmare, if you can, keep as still as possible in the position that you woke up, right? And then replay it again the way you want it to go.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that.
Yeah, and it works. Right? Mm. I've made another note here, actually, because isn't it just, your imagination? Well,
There's nothing else.
Everything is, isn't it? Yeah. Except the present, other than the present moment, everything's imagination.
Yeah.
Right? But now the Plymouth University, I was going to send it to one of my clients, actually. Plymouth University have actually done a piece of research using functional imagery therapy. It's called functional image therapy.
Functional image therapy?
Yeah, therapy. Right. And you know what it is?
Biofeedback.
Just imagining yourself as the weight you want to be. Yeah. It was about with weight loss students, So you imagine yourself the weight you want to be, and you keep imagining, really associate into the picture, right? Mm. And the greater percentage of the people who did it lost weight. So now this piece of research.
You scooted past something before quite quickly, and you told it to me in shorthand because you're talking to a coach and you know that I know what you're talking about. But you said you ran the woman through what she wished had happened for 20 minutes over and over again. And you scooted through that because you know it, I know it, and it's a very simple technique, but powerful. Oh, okay. That kind of military drill where you go, what did you want to have happen? Imagine it happening. Right, now we're doing it again. Well, we just did it. No, we're doing it again. Now do it again. Now do it again. Now do it. And that's why the military drills that way, why martial arts drills that way. It's drilling it into your unconscious. It's not supposed to. I had somebody say to me on a hypnotherapy audio I gave her, she said, well, I know what you're going to say next because I heard it 5 times. It's like, it's not a fucking bedtime story. This is reprogramming your unconscious. I'm not trying to entertain you. Be bored. Be bored and go through it and keep going. It's that we're laying down a new neural pathway. It's going to be a bit dull. It's going to be slightly uncomfortable, and you're going to be like, "Oh, here we go again." But what the brain was doing previously was going horror, horror. Don't do this. Don't let this happen again. Don't let this happen again. And you're going, "All right, brain, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. This is what." And you, as many times as the brain is sending the alarm, going, "Don't do that," you're going to fire back with, "We'll do this. We'll do this. We'll do this." Self-protection training.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
is that, isn't it?
Yeah, building new instincts in a way. Like, but they go. They talk about the question about do we use hypnotherapy and all the rest of it. All of this, you can either say it's from this book over here called Hypnosis, or it's this book called NLP, or it's this book called CBT, and it's like, it's just whatever works. Because even in drilling those better versions, you've got the opportunity to make that to start to attenuate the better version, make it brighter, louder, all those sorts of things, bring it closer. That's the NLP book. Well, is it? Or is it the hypnosis book? But it doesn't matter at all. And it comes back to, I think, the best tool that anybody has for any change is their imagination. Get yourself to imagine the better situation. And if you're imagining the better one, at that moment, you cannot be imagining the worse one. So drill more the better one, drill more the better one, drill more the better one. So, all the things we've said, it's your story before about. So the old way, the old pathway gets covered in weeds now because you've cut the new one through a new, more resourceful and helpful one.
The NLP presupposition of we don't take away choice, we add to. Okay, so the choices, we've got, that's a better choice than this. It's much more ecological, whatever you want to call it.
Taking that comes back to, how do you get choice? You know, we've talked about triggers and, you know, automatic actions and all this, and you talked about the gap between stimulus and response, the gap into which we bring choice. How do we get choice?
Realize that you have choice, first of all. And so what else could you do instead? What else could you do instead? Ad nauseum. Until it becomes an unconscious thing. Go, I can do this,
That's where I think what you guys do is it's almost like a kind of physical intervention, which is you're forcing a part of the brain that wouldn't normally be activated through trauma to vividly imagine with emotions what it would be like if it was another way.
Yeah.
And you're both very good at that. You do it more, both of you do it more than I do. Dragging the client to the point of going, well, what would you be doing if you weren't doing this? And if you didn't want to think that, what do you want to think instead? And making them go through that.
Do you want another one of my metaphors?
Oh, I'm gagging for one of them, Teze.
Okay.
I'm gagging here, lad.
What? I use the analogy of a horse.
Interesting.
Right? You bring a horse, a kingdom for an horse, right? The horse, right, your brain's going to do it anyway. Your brain's going to make stuff up anyway. You know, leave stuff out, make stuff up, group stuff together. It's going to do it whether you like it or not, right? And it doesn't care how it does it, whether it's useful or unuseful, right? And it's like having a horse, and it just goes with it once. Right. What we're doing now is putting reins on the horse, and you're going, no, this way. This way.
Neddy.
This way. This way, Neddy. That'll be the name of the next Dobbin exercise we release. It'll be called This Way, Neddy.
The other thing is that choice thing that is key, maybe, is being aware, noticing whatever it is, the emotion, the feeling, we disregard these things often, don't we? We just disregard or we accept it as, I just feel really shit, I don't know what's going on or something. So hang on, stop and notice. And from there, then, I don't have to go by default. I can start to, then that's the gap starting to open up again. So what can I do? And I think left to your own devices, you might be unable to think of other things you can do. But that's why I think the work with the coach will say, let's just explore. Let's explore that gap. What other choices have you got? And then, you say, what's the craziest thing you could do? What would be maybe illegal to do? Doesn't matter. It's just going to open the gap of choices.
Explode it out. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I like that.
One of the useful things that I've come across is putting things in your way. So so instead of running the pattern, you put things in front. You distort the pattern. Right.
Or interference, that type of thing.
To give you an example, and an example I use it quite often, somebody who was a guy who was a martial artist actually. Eating too much chocolate. He wanted to stop eating chocolates because he was eating all crap and he wanted to be sharp, lose some weight. So I said, okay, well, how do you know when to do it? And he said, well, I come in through the back door, to the kitchen door. I drop my tool bag on the floor. I see on the cupboard there with the crisps and the chocolate there, There's an island, like in the kitchen, right? And I said, okay, so we pulled it out just like sort of, if that's the trigger in the routine, we pull it out so that there's a gap, right? And it can't quite go back the same way, right? So where's it? Well, that's another way of doing it. But also, so there's the pattern. So what I asked him to do, because it was crisps, what I had to do was get some apples and put it in the island, right? And have as many bags of crisps as you want, right? But you're gonna need to eat an apple first.
Right.
Now, it's first he started eating an apple, then having a bag of crisps. But then
he ate all the crisps, I tell you. What?
Yeah. Well, I'm on commission from Golden Monthly, you see. But over time, he stopped at the apple.
Right.
One of the reasons is because I think, because again, this is something I picked up over the years, learned from someone else. The crunching of the apple satisfied that crunchy bit, but also it broke up the pattern.
Yeah.
It's another chance for him to go, okay.
Yeah. I had some the other day. I've never had them before. Jalapeno and cheese.
That
sounds nice.
That sounds morally corrupt to me.
Jalapeno and cheese crisps.
You both.
I tell you what, I would
eat them, and you would eat them.
Oh yeah. Who would he buy? This is important. Who would he buy?
Crisp maker. I don't know.
Well, on the jalapeno and chili crisp note, we're going to end this here, you pair of morally corrupt decadents.
I didn't know we'd started. What have we been doing?
Yeah, that's it now, Steve. It's over now, mate.
But I've got all my... No.
I've got all this sensible stuff I wanted to say.
Never.
Thank you. Is there anything else you want to add?
No.
Nope.
No, he doesn't.
Was that a note for me as well, was it?
He doesn't.
He doesn't. He's fine. We're finished here.
So it's a note from me.
Shut him up.
I know.
It's a note from me.
I'm sort of feeling metaphor overload at the moment.
I can tell you a story about that, you know.
No, do not. Thank you very much, and goodbye.